Hello and welcome back. We're going to be looking at the future in this podcast and thinking about how things change after this historic challenge that the world is facing. And there's nobody better to think about that with than Dave Bujnowski, who is a member of the Baillie Gifford US equity team. So Dave, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Gary. Thanks for having me.
Right. So I think, as I said, we want to be thinking about what the future might hold. And we're thinking obviously particularly in terms of in response to this historic event, the coronavirus crisis and the measures taken to contain it. So perhaps you could give us a guide. How do you go about thinking about what the future is going to be like after something like this?
Yeah, I think after something like this are the operative words there, with humility and curiosity, frankly. And I think that's an important place to start from. The virus is complex by its nature, and the web of the human network that we all live in is a complex system as well. And I think what happens next, frankly, is unpredictable. I suspect some of the biggest changes coming from it will be second or third order effects that occur decades from now. That said, I do think there are some threads and patterns that we can begin to work from. And the context here, this is my starting point, is that collectively we've had a major behavioral change forced upon us, changes that affect virtually every aspect of our lives, our work, our entertainment, our childcare, our health, and so on. And with that, many of the norms that we've accepted as givens in life have been removed in one fell swoop. And I think this begs what I think are the most fascinating questions is, what if the norm is no longer even possible? Or what if what you did as second nature is no longer an option? And with a clean slate like that and new mindsets and new technologies, might we identify new and better ways to go about our lives? So that's sort of what I focused the white paper on that I wrote. And it's what drew me back to this concept of accumulated accidents.
Okay, so what's expand on that then? What's an accumulated accident?
Yeah, it's a concept that Clay Shirky introduced in his book Cognitive Surplus about 10 years ago. And ever since I read the book, I was fascinated by this idea of accumulated accidents, as he called it. And what they are, I think COVID just presents a fascinating case study on how to approach these accumulated accidents. But what they are, it's a concept that looks at things that we consider sacred, whether that's an institution, a behavior, a product, a tradition, and it challenges whether that thing really does represent an ideal state of society or whether it's sitting on far more shaky ground. Perhaps there's a better way and we just need a stimulant to change and disrupt the status quo. And I think what interests me is that I think we all sometimes tend to think that things are the way they are because society, from our technologies to our belief systems, have evolved to some natural end state, right? Not appreciating that this is just a moment in time. And in some cases, things are the way they are as the result of a series of events, perhaps even accidents, that got us here and that sometimes can be unwound in the right circumstances and lead to a disruption.
Okay, so there's a few concepts in there. I think they'd probably be best served if you were able to offer an example or a few examples, whichever's easiest about.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yep. So in the white paper I mentioned, I elaborate on the subject matter that Shirky himself focused on in his book, specifically that's media. And the context here is the book was published in 2010. And at the time, the media landscape, at least when it came to video entertainment, let's say, was dominated by professionally created content, the TV sitcom that was presented in, half hour or hour long blocks at a certain night at a certain time. Back then, user generated content was still considered a fad or at least a niche. YouTube was only 5 years old, having been acquired by Google for just 1.65 billion in 2006. That shows how social media and user generated content was still so young then. At that point, Facebook had yet to amass even 500 million monthly average users. All this social media was a fringe, and what was considered sacred, and I can remember this from, you know, when I was a boy, sacred, resilient, seemingly unshakable was the passive, you know, laugh track laden broadcast TV sitcom that still ruled the day. So Shirky looked at that current state, that media landscape, and kind of reverse engineered how we got to that point and identified that, no, it's not sacred. It's not an ideal state of society whatsoever. It's just a series of accumulated accidents that have happened over the last 40 years to get the sitcom to be the norm, but it wasn't by any stretch ideal. And if you look at this situation through a different lens, you can see potentially a better way. And I thought COVID was a trigger that could create that type of, or shine a light on some accumulated accidents today, and see if they can be deconstructed and give way to a different way of living.
So what was the problem then that the sitcom was trying to solve? What way has it missed the target, yeah, so to speak?
Sure. I'll try to keep this brief, but what Shirky went all the way back to the very beginnings of video entertainment and observed that there was a confluence of some really profound changes in society that led to a very passive approach to being entertained. What he spoke about was the suburbanization of America, sort of people after World War II leaving the cities, you know, these suburbs being created. And from that came a social unrest that, you know, we weren't used to living separate from one another. And it created, I'm paraphrasing, but it sort of created this angst in society. It was a new way of living. There was unrest. And from that place, he posited that we seek things to help numb our angst. And entertainment and TV was the perfect thing for that. It just so happened to occur at the same time that the technologies and the media ecosystem were starting to build, so that it all sort of led to this, as I said, this sort of confluence of you have viewers who wanted to be numbed because they were living in this new world that they weren't comfortable with. And they were given this new form of entertainment where all they were asked to do was sit back on a couch and be entertained too. And what Shirky said that while that fit, you know, from, let's say, 1950 to 2010, that's sort of what we hired TV to do. It wasn't necessarily the best way if you were to start from a clean slate. And he suggested that humans want not just to be entertained too passively, but they also want to create. They also want to connect. They want to interact. And he suggested that social media was that. It was just that. It was a form of entertainment, but it was also drawing people in a way that was so much more stimulating and satisfying than sitting back as you know, a couch potato. And he I think very, very effectively predicted the rise of you know, some of the social media platforms that we see today, that yes, they are entertaining. Some of us sit back and let the feed blast us passively, but other people use it as a form of self-expression, as a form of creation, as a form of connecting with other people.
So social media is the unwinding of the series of accumulated accidents that led to conventional media. Is that the idea?
That is the idea. Yeah, that's my interpretation of it. Yep.
And what are the broader implications then of the current state being the result of accumulated accidents?
I think it's creative destruction. I think the hero in this whole story is innovation, right? Right. The unwinding of an accumulated accident leads to a different, perhaps not always better, but a different way. And as an investor, I recognize that there's often an opportunity on the other side of this unwind or this deconstruction of an accumulated accident, a new market that forms, tending to the job the old one did, often with new participants that can benefit. So as an investor, I see tremendous implications from this notion of accumulated accidents and being able to put yourself in a position to perhaps predict when one might unwind and give way to something new.
And COVID would be a catalyst for that unwinding process then.
I think it does. Yeah, obviously, in 2010, Shirky didn't predict any of this. But when I saw just 3 weeks into what we were all living through as we were being forced to stay at home and quarantine and shelter in place and work from home, the question that we asked in our team was, okay, we see some just unprecedented behavior change. Which of these might last? Which of these might not? When things, if and when they go back to, quote unquote normal in a post-COVID world, which of the behaviors that we are now being forced to, that have been introduced into our lives will endure? So I thought that, yeah, COVID was, Shirky talking about media was this, as I said, it was written in 2010 and 10 years later, we're still in a world where, sitcoms are popular and many among us still watch TV just like we might have watched it 20 years ago. It's a very slow moving process. And I think what COVID has done is to sort of beg the question of, wow, okay, which of these accidents might now be forced to unwind in one fell swoop and really quickly?
And I know that you, when thinking about which ones will unwind, when thinking about disruptions will last, you've got a kind of a framework for thinking about the factors that would necessitate that, haven't you? So how do we determine which accumulated accidents are going to unwind?
Yeah, there are undoubtedly other ways to approach this, but I offered three perspectives in the paper. First, as a starting point, I think we need to assess the core job, for lack of a better phrase, that a product addresses or a technology addresses, and ask whether a new solution addresses it in a more effective way than it was addressed in the past. So as we talked about, this would be Shirky and social media tending to the job of being entertained and connected and self-expression in a way that previous forms of media couldn't. So I think it's pretty straightforward, but it also asks us to consider what trade-offs have come with the existing way of doing things. What are the necessary evils we've lived with in going about our lives? Can they be addressed while the core job is also being solved just as effectively? I think that would be almost a necessary but insufficient condition to lead to the unwinding of an accumulated accident. But the second thing I offered was an understanding of the broader ecosystem in which an existing behavior exists. So I think the strength of that ecosystem will inform how likely it is to unwind or not. These are the buttresses and inertia to keep a way of doing things in place. It can literally be an ecosystem. It can be regulation. It can include culture. How deeply ingrained in culture is a particular behavior? The deeper it is, the less likely we are to change, even during a tumultuous period like COVID. And finally,
highly analogous to sort of the five forces of competitive advantage or something. Is it like barriers to entry that are the barriers to the unwinding of an established way of doing things?
Yeah, I think you just led to the third way I approached it, was understanding motivations and deterrents that support an existing way of doing things, which I think most psychologists would suggest are at the root of behavioral change, thinking about motivations and deterrents. And you mentioned, you know, barrier to entry and things like that. I'm fascinated by this tension between a motivation, like I want to do something differently, and a deterrent, which would be the friction point that prevents me from doing things. And it's that last bit, the deterrence part, that I think was where my biggest personal unlock was in writing the paper. And you know, I've thought a lot about impediments and friction points over the years, but the question I had never considered before is a distinction between a friction point that, when removed, is a one-way door, i.e., you know, they're removed once and for all, or whether it's a friction point that would be removed temporarily, you know, during COVID, but then once that force is removed, it resurfaces and we revert to an old way of doing something. So,
and I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I think a classic example of that was that there was an expectation, or there was a big increase in video conferencing and stuff after the September 11th attacks, but ultimately people went back to business travel fairly quickly after that, in a way that I guess it's for everyone to speculate about whether that's going to happen this time around.
Yeah, that's a great example. And I think, you know, close to 20 years removed from that, we have changed as a culture and a society. The technologies that support video conferencing have had 2 decades to improve. And I think, so when I think about deterrence and, you know, whether it's embedded in culture or not, when I talk about these one-way door, deterrence, something that would fit into that category is awareness. You know, just to break it down to its simplest form, if I was not aware that there was another way of doing something, and now I'm forced into a new type of behavior, and I'm you know, I'm now aware that, oh geez, I can do this now. You know, that would be one form of a one and done deterrent removal. So I'd look for situations like that. Efficacy is another one. Like, does this actually work? Now that I'm being forced to try this video conferencing at home, or buying this type of food online as opposed to going to the store, and it's actually effective and I get what I think I'm going to get, that is, I think, can be another example of sort of a one and done deterrent.
So, I mean, maybe you could you could give us some examples of things that you think are going to change then, for, you know, that where that change has been catalyzed by COVID, and you feel like it's a change that's going to last, or a change that's going to evolve further. Yeah.
Yep. I think working from home is a fascinating case study, particularly because, to your point, it didn't change 20 years ago when a lot of people were forced into video conferencing. We went back to normal. But I think now I do think that there is going to be a change. Exactly what that change looks like, I think, is still to be determined. But I don't think we are going to go back to the old way of work. If we think about, you know, how we worked previously, flying around the world to visit people face to face, commuting for sometimes hours each day to get to and from the office, the core job in all that, if you ask, you know, shine a light on that, what is the core job? Okay, to connect, to communicate, to collaborate, to transfer knowledge and information, and so on. And that is, I think, you know, 5 or 6 months into this, more and more companies and more employers and employees are seeing that we can do all that now. Whether that's because we've culturally changed over the last 20 years, or I think also very clearly a function of a different technology, so that how we do this, and, you know, services like Zoom allow us to do it in a way that's so much more frictionless than it was 20 years ago. So, and I think even then asking about the trade-offs that we were forced to live with in the old way of doing things, the hours lost each day commuting, time away from family, cost of air travel, carbon footprint on impact on the environment, in flying, you know, to business meetings. So I think that is one that I do expect it to be a lasting change, absolutely.
And so when we think of Baillie Gifford, obviously we think of an investment team that is really kind of looking to the future, and looking for changes in trends. And now we've had COVID, I guess the very easy way of looking at that is to think it's just brought forward a lot of the change that was going to happen anyway. But has this very insightful piece that you've written and this way that you've got of thinking about things, has it changed anything in terms of the investment choices that you're making?
A bit, yeah. So I would say, I would start by saying that started really from where I started from with that point about humility. We're not making sweeping changes in the portfolio, largely because I think there's still many chapters in the story that it's not clear on how it'll unfold. But as I said, I do think the paper and the thinking around accumulated accidents and stuff get us something to work with. But yes, we have made changes. The first, I mentioned this in the piece, as far as implications, enterprise software in the cloud. Speaking to the point earlier about motivations, I think enterprises of all shapes and sizes, whether we're working from home 5 days a week or just asking for a bit more flexibility, enterprises are going to be forced or incentivized to do more with less and to be more agile. Two of the promises that come with cloud computing. So we've added a handful of ideas in the past 4 or 5 months that play off of this theme. Things like Twilio, Slack, Cloudflare, Datadog are the companies to mention. The second two that I'd call out, they're related. The first is e-commerce, which I know sounds kind of long in the tooth in some areas, but e-commerce with regards to categories that were still very fringe, very early in the shift to online, and that might accelerate now. So, you know, we were already exposed to a lot of this with companies like Wayfair and home furnishing, Chewy, relative to pet food. But as the crisis unfolded, I think, you know, while we didn't trade or add Chewy or Wayfair, it helped us sit on our hands and ride through the volatility, just thinking that these companies are really well positioned for the future, maybe even more so than they were previously. But other categories like that we've gotten involved in would be the used car market in the U.S. Very, very early in the shift online. It's a massive market that's just beginning to shift. So companies like Carvana and Vroom. And then last guy, I'd say categories or situations that would, this might sound a little funny, but that would complete the following sentence. I just need to find time to go to blank. I think fill in that word blank. I think we'd be well served to think about any situations that we were forced to go to. And the point is we'd rather have services come to us. Think about all the ways this has happened over the years. E-commerce with Amazon, entertainment with Netflix, knowledge with Google, social interaction with Facebook. So what else is up for grabs? You know, perhaps gyms in the era of Peloton. I think it's a fascinating question. The office, given what Zoom can do. The doctor's office, now that many of us have experienced the convenience of telemedicine. So in the portfolio, we have had positions in both Teladoc in telemedicine and Zoom, obviously in the workplace, and we're still involved in both of those.
Okay. Oh, that's a really interesting example, I guess, with Disney having just announced that they're being forced to release Mulan, their new production, straight to Disney Plus, because it's obviously not going to be practical to get big numbers into movie theaters to see it. So maybe it will be, you know, maybe that will be an example of things that either temporarily or permanently unwind the idea of going to the movies again. Okay, well, I think that's been a really interesting way of looking at and trying to sort of work out what the current events or the current way of doing things, how that might evolve over the future. So, Dave Budzinowski, thank you so much for sharing that with us. I think it's been really interesting, and thanks also to all of our listeners. Hopefully, you've enjoyed this Bruin podcast, and hopefully, you'll join us again next time.